Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
There's nothing like being in the stands cheering on your favorite team. GameTime is your hack to unlocking amazing tickets in just a few taps. Plus, their GameTime guarantee means you can trust you'll get 100% authentic tickets at the best price. Fees are always included, so what you see is what you pay. Get the best deals on sports tickets. Download the GameTime app and create an account to start searching for tickets to upcoming games and events. Swipe, tap, ticket, go. GameTime.
Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm spiffy.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, 28 years later, director Danny Boyle stirred the pot when he told The Guardian that he wouldn't be able to make his Oscar-winning hit Slumdog Millionaire today, and that he's fine with that. I want to read Boyle's full quote here, because some of the truncated clips have been a little misconstrued, I think. All right, so here it is, quote, "Yeah, we wouldn't be able to make that now, and that's how it should be. It's time to reflect on all that. We have to look at the cultural baggage we carry and the mark that we've left on the world. At the time, it felt radical. We made the decision that only a handful of us would go to Mumbai. We'd work with a big Indian crew and try to make a film within the culture. But you're still an outsider. It's still a flawed method. That kind of cultural appropriation might be sanctioned at certain times, but at other times, it cannot be. I mean, I'm proud of that film, but you wouldn't even contemplate doing something like that today. It wouldn't even get financed. Even if I was involved, I'd be looking for a young Indian filmmaker to shoot it." End quote. I think it's worth noting that there are two separate ideas here, right? One is the question of whether or not Boyle himself would make a movie like this today. And he says, no, he wouldn't. That's totally his prerogative. Saying he would prefer the film to be made by a young Indian filmmaker is the correct sort of patronizing, in a way, which is to say it's patronage. And I don't really have an issue with that. The filmmakers can pick and choose what they desire to make all they like, right? You can lift up young filmmakers all you want. In some ways, I would say that's the responsibility of a great filmmaker, to find somebody new and continue on the grand tradition of the cinema. I think there's also something to the idea that people understand and can convey information about their own cultures in interesting and unique ways, right? The two best movies of the year so far, from my point of view, are Sinners and 28 Years Later. And the first is very explicitly a movie about Black Americans, told from the perspective of a Black American. And the second is very explicitly an English movie about English identity and English self-conception. Where I get, I don't know, antsy is the use of the word should in that first bit, right? We wouldn't be able to make that now, and that's how it should be. And I'm sorry, I just reject that. I reject it out of hand. Stories are stories. Stories are stories. And even if you're telling the story of another culture, that's simply part of culture, part of the broad array of storytelling, part of the evolution of how stories work and how myths spread, et cetera, et cetera. This idea that you can only tell stories about your own people or your own type of people or your own culture should be anathema to anyone who actually believes in art and artistry and the communal experience of creating and consuming art, right? if art is, in fact, you know, the great empathy machine, right, as Roger Ebert said, then you got to be able to make stuff about other cultures. Otherwise, you can't empathize with them. And I'm sorry, it's also just I hate to play this card. I just find it weirdly racist to focus only on the idea that races when the races of the cultures in question are different is where the problem comes in. Right. Like Boyle made a great movie about Scottish identity, Trainspotting, despite being English. Is that cultural appropriation? Maybe, maybe not. It all falls under Britain. I don't know. When he made The Beach, that's a movie about an American backpacker. Should he be forbidden from telling the story about that individual? I don't know. Probably not. Tangentially, I've always found it very funny that there was a lot of hand-wringing discourse about Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs because it was set in Japan, despite Anderson's previous film, Grand Budapest Hotel, being set in a fictionalized Austro-Hungarian empire. I'm sorry, he's a white dude from Houston. He has an equal connection to either locale. Either they're both appropriation or neither is. But to get hung up on skin color is just weird. I find it weird. But then I am a monstrous bigot. I acknowledge that. That's my problem. Alyssa, is he right to say that white filmmakers should avoid making movies about India?
No. And I think there's a flip side to this that people who make those kind of declarations almost never consider, which is that if you tie people to only telling stories about the communities of which they're a part, that will end up foreclosing opportunities for a lot of people in minority groups, right? You know, I think the classic example of this is the argument about whether only trans actors should play trans characters. And I think that, again, sort of the flip side of this is that if you say people can only sort of play characters of their gender identity, you're also going to ultimately foreclose trans actors from playing cis people, right? And I think there are always going to be a lot more cisgender characters in movies and television. And so if you want to say that, like any one of a number of actors can't play cisgendered characters, they're going to be shut out of an enormous amount of work. And so, you know, I am all for, like, I love the idea of, you know, Bollywood directors coming in and doing their own spins on Pride and Prejudice. I think Steve McQueen, who's a Black British director, made, you know, Hunger, which is a searing movie about the Troubles and Irish political prisoners. Like, should Steve McQueen not be allowed to make that movie? I think that would be insane. And so, you know, there is, I think, in this kind of conversation, a weird pretense at ceding space that actually ends up setting a standard that would circumscribe the work of, artists of color, of trans and queer artists. And I think it's ultimately kind of self-defeating. Do I think that, you know, people like, you know, people who are inspired by traditions not their own should do everything they can to elevate, you know, people who work in those traditions, great works in those traditions? Yeah, but you should do that because you love that work, not because it's sort of charity or because you want to circumscribe anybody's sort of range of artistic potential.
There's also just the fact that a lot of the times if you limit who can be in these things, the things themselves don't get made, right? Like there was a big argument about Scarlett Johansson being in this movie Rub and Tug is what it was called. It was about a trans sex worker at a massage parlor or something. And this had come kind of on the heels of her being in the Ghost in the Shell movie, which created all sorts of other headaches. She got yelled at. And people were very, very mean and very nasty online. And she was like, fine, I'm not going to do it. And then the movie never got made. The story never got told. The movie never got made. There was a couple years later, there was an effort to get it made as a TV series. Shocker, that's still in development. Like it just didn't happen. And that's the other downside here, right? Like, is that the stuff just doesn't get made. If you say only certain people can make this, only certain people can star in this, that stuff just doesn't exist now. That's a problem. I don't know. Peter, what do you make of this?
I mean, I think it's not just that cultural appropriation is okay, right? We can come, you know, that it, we shouldn't be bothered by it or whatever. It's that it's an affirmative good in a lot of cases. I'm sure that someone could present me with some sort of case study or instance or example where I said, maybe that's in poor taste. But if you think about other art forms like food, for example, like it's cooking is just blending up, it's not always blending, right? Cooking is just mixing a whole bunch of different ideas together. That is where a huge amount of innovation like comes through. This is true in virtually all arts, is that people borrow and adapt and update and synthesize. And we should want a kind of cultural, mix and match for art, maybe not in every case. And that doesn't mean that, you know, that art that only borrows, that only sort of draws from one tradition is bad or anything like that. But there's just a kind of, there's an affirmative good to art that draws from many different traditions, many different cultures and many different backgrounds that you lose if you say that people can only tell stories about or only make food from or only paint or I don't even know what things that have a, you know, that are directly part of their own personal background and culture. And, you know, I just think you end up limiting art so much if the world if the world of art is constrained to only your own experience and, you know, cultural, ethnic, whatever background. I mean, if that were true, then, you know, the easy thing for us to say is, oh, well, you know, this is it, that I could only make art about sort of 40-year-old white male writers, right? Or podcasters or whatever, right? But it's like even more than that, I think. You end up turning every piece of art into a kind of narrow focus memoir, because if an artist cannot tell stories beyond his or her or their own, then memoir is all that's left. Memoir can be fine. I like some memoirs, but the world needs a lot more than that.
You see this come up a lot in the world of YA fiction, right, Alyssa? Isn't this like a big aspect in that field?
Own voices hashtag, like,
right? You have advanced readers and reviewers saying, well, this book is no good because the character is autistic and
you had the blow up over American Dirt, and like Janine Cummings is trying to sort of, you know, has been attempting a literary comeback. Like, I mean, I think the other element of this, and one of the reasons I find it sort of disturbing that it's operating in YA fiction, is that it sort of suggests that curiosity and empathy and research are bad things, or that they're like just sort of inherently lesser to lived experience. Like, I actually, you know, I mean, one of my favorite nonfiction books is Anne Fadiman's The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. And, you know, Anne is, you know, white American, and she ended up spending years with this Hmong family in Merced, whose daughter had a severe seizure disorder. And Anne is not Hmong. She's not, she's not a medical professional, but she has this really interesting section in the book about how her relative sort of inexperience and lack of power and status made her, made people much more comfortable sort of talking to her and explaining things to her. And like, the book is wonderful in part because it is from this place of empathy and curiosity. It doesn't assume what anybody knows. She doesn't have sort of preconceptions. She's able to sort of translate between these two worlds that were unable to speak to each other precisely because of her lack of membership in either one. That sort of lack of experience and status ended up being really crucial to the reporting of the book. And so if you say that, like, you know, sort of curiosity is always appropriative, once again, I think that suggests that people ought to live in like these very narrow boxes. And I just, you know, as a way to live your life, I think that sucks. It's just, it's sort of unpleasant. And I think it's counterproductive to these goals.
100%. Something you mentioned here reminded me of a story I think we covered before on this show. And I hate the phrase lived experience. The idea that lived experience is the only sort of valid expression or way of viewing or writing about the world strikes me as deeply deranged and, like, frankly, unhealthy. But there was a few years back, there was the Grey's Anatomy writer. You guys remember the story? The Grey's Anatomy writer who, like, invented a cancer diagnosis and, like, would dominate the writer's room. And would, like, be like, as a cancer survivor myself, here's what the plot line should be. And that's insane. That's an insane thing. But it's also just
responding. It incentivizes fraud. It incentivizes fraud.
Totally. Yeah. That's what I was about to say. I mean, like, she's just responding to incentives. Like, she's acting rationally here because the world is dumb. But you know, I digress. It's I find this whole thing fascinating. I do want to say though, again, I admire Boyle in one way, which is that I do think that there is value to having new and interesting voices brought on board to tell stories. Like, that is absolutely a valid thing for him to do. Like, I think that would be. That would be great. And we see some of this with Dev Patel, right? Who was in Slumdog Millionaire and made Monkey Man recently, which is very much an Indian story told from an Indian filmmaker.
And was in The Green Knight, right? You know, doing this, like, playing this, you know, sort of, you know, version of the Arthurian legend, kind of refracted through the cosmopolitan version of Britain that has resulted in part because of the sort of the terrible evils of colonialism, right? And look, there are absolutely things that someone in Danny Boyle's position can do that are really helpful, right? I mean, if you get someone, you know, enough hours of work or, like, whatever the financial threshold is to, like, get SAG membership or to get membership in any one of the guilds in a way that, like, makes it easier for them to keep working. Like, you know, it's so much better to give people opportunities than to recede from the stage.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-troversy to say non-Indian filmmakers should not make movies about India? Peter?
It's kind of a controversy, but it's also practically it's sort of a non-troversy. People have been saying this stuff for a while, and it doesn't seem to have as much hold on things as it did even a few years ago, and that's a good thing.
Alyssa?
I mean, it's a controversy, but one that springs from good intentions, and so is something that's, like, where it's like my reaction would be to sort of be corrective rather than condemnatory. Like, I'm not mad at Danny Boyle. He's just wrong.
It's a controversy, and everybody should be mad at him. Everybody yell at Danny Boyle. No, I like don't yell. But, like, I again, it's not even it's the should that bothers me. It's the should not the kind of, like, well, you know, I did it, but really, kids, you shouldn't either. It's like, I learned it from you, Dad. You know, don't give us that. Don't give us that. I don't appreciate it. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday because we're going to be doing a Danny Boyle draft. We love Danny Boyle. Look, I love Danny Boyle. You know, I'm not gonna hold this against him for too long. Maybe another 2 minutes here. But he's one of our great filmmakers. We're gonna be talking about his new one now. On to the main event. 28 Years Later. It's the sequel to, of course, 28 Days Later and 28 Weeks Later. 28 Years Later. Skip the months. Begins with a brief prologue in Scotland, where we see a family that get destroyed by people infected by the rage virus. Flash forward 28 years later, and the action moves to Holy Island, where a village of English persons, live connected to the mainland by a causeway that floods for most of the day, which keeps the mindless rage-infected zombies on the other side of the water. 28 years later feels a bit like three different movies, right? The first is a fairly straightforward legacy sequel, one that adds to series lore while also playing like a pretty straightforward zombie action thriller, right? The film follows Spike, who's played by Alfie Williams, and his dad, Jamie, who's played by Aaron Taylor Johnson, as Spike makes his first trip to the mainland. It's, you know, kind of a rite of passage sort of thing. Young British boy going off to war, etc. In addition to the, you know, kind of standard fast zombies from the first two films, there are also these big, fat, grub-like zombies subsisting on worms and bugs crawling along the ground. And there are also huge, hulking alpha zombies. They're strong enough to rip a deer's head right off its haunches. This is all well done and thrilling and also visually inventive. The kind of pseudo bullet time effect that Boyle's iPhone array can create is pretty astounding, and it's not overused, which is nice. It also just looks great. Like the cinema, again, this movie is shot on iPhones, but you know, with fancy lenses and that sort of thing, but it looks so good. It looks like shockingly good. Thematically, it is very resonant as well. And he achieves a lot of that through editing, right? It's a movie that is obsessed with the idea of what it means to conceive of oneself as British or really English, how English myths and how the English past inform the English present, how the cinematic imagery of England, of archers on battlements firing at onrushing hordes, of boys readying themselves to head off to the trenches of World War One, images of valor, or, you know, quote, valor, end quote, still defines what the English think of when they think of themselves as British, English, whatever. The second movie is a movie about families and love and loss. It follows Spike as he takes his mother, Isla, who's played by Jodie Comer, to the mainland in the hopes of he can find a doctor who can help her. She's obviously very sick as the movie starts, suffering from some sort of disease that keeps her in bed most of the day. I won't veer into spoiler territory yet. I assume we'll talk about this in a second. But I would like to give Ralph Fiennes a shout out for his performance in this portion of the movie. He is one of our most underutilized comic actors. And while this is not, strictly speaking, a comedic role, he plays the kind of Colonel Kurtz-esque part he has been assigned here, with sort of mannered British fussiness and politeness that is often very funny. The third movie, again, three movies, the third movie is... It consists of the prologue and the coda. It's kind of a half short movie. But it sets up the sequel, which is coming January of next year. And again, no spoilers here, but I loved the last 5 minutes of this movie, which have a bonkers, sinister energy to them that is just not anywhere else in this movie. It is such an out of left field sequence that I imagine audiences are either going to like really love it like I did or be really turned off by it. But I was literally like laughing out. I was like guffawing at the screen as it was happening. It was just joyful. I was watching it all go down. Anyway, I kind of love this movie, which is completely different from what I thought it would be. And maybe because it was completely different from what I thought it would be. Peter, what did you make of 28 Years Later?
I also loved this movie, and that final sequence is great just because it's such a wonderfully bizarre note to end on, and also it's setting us up for a sequel that has already been shot and is coming in January, directed by Nia DaCosta, also written by Alex Garland, who is one of, I think, all three of our favorites on this podcast. And this is such a great melding of the visions sort of and sensibilities of Alex Garland and Danny Boyle, the kind of hyperactive, frenetic, stylistic stuff that you get from Boyle, right? And Boyle's occasionally strange sense of both despair and hope. He is often a filmmaker who can, I think, at times veer into the saccharine even. But here, Garland really keeps him kind of grounded, and there's the push and the pull between their sort of two worldviews is so great. But in a lot of ways, this movie reminded me of Civil War, which is Garland's film from last year, just because, like Civil War, it's a sort of episodic travelogue that that culminates in like a big big set piece sequence. Although in this case, the big set piece sequence is this really kind of strikingly calm thing, rather than the gnarly aggro assault on the White House that we get at the end of Civil War. But it's a tour of a place, that has grown into a sort of dysfunction where the rules no longer apply. It's the story that Alex Garland has been telling forever. But then we get this Danny Boyleism, which is, nearly spastic at times, hyperactive, incredibly stylish, just rapid fire, cinematography. But what really stood out to me about this is, yes, this is very much a movie about what it means to be British and how the history of being British informs that culture even after the zombie apocalypse, even long after, right? And how you can never really totally escape this. It's a dark movie in many ways, but when you get to that Ralph Fiennes sequence at the end, you get something that it's not just that I wasn't expecting. It's that I found really kind of profoundly moving in a way that I was quite surprised by from what I thought was going to be a dark, grim zombie movie. And it is dark and grim at times, pretty gory. I should warn people, if you're really sensitive, maybe this isn't the movie for you. But you remember, we all remember 28 Days Later. And 28 Days Later was a great movie. Also a travelogue, also ended in this big third act sequence, right? Sort of that like brought everything together. But man, that movie was grim. That was a movie that was so cynical about human nature and so just bleak about the world and the prospects for surviving in it. And, right, like it's a little bit of a cliche now. And yes, I know there are the Romero films, which were quite political for decades beforehand. But this was really a sort of quantum leap in the way that that zombie movies not just presented the fast zombies, but also used zombies to sort of reflect on contemporary politics. And this was about a society that was sort of being that was either choosing or being pressed into trading freedom for security, right? And it was, that man is the real monster. And what do we get in this film? We get almost literally the reverse. The monsters are maybe the real men. And instead of society just collapsing into horror, it's rough out there for sure. This is not a movie that's all like everything's just sort of like nice, flowers and puppy dogs. But maybe from the ashes, some sort of civilization rises up, perhaps even in the most unexpected ways and the most unexpected places. And in that, you see this in the Ralph Fiennes character, you can find some measure of grace and beauty and appreciation at the strangeness and wonderfulness of life, even in a post-apocalyptic scenario. And it's such a great pair with the original, because it takes all of those ideas and without in any way sort of looking back and being like that we hate our own first movie. This movie is not like, it's not saying the first movie is wrong. It is saying the first movie and that grimness and that bleakness, all that cynicism and darkness, it's not the final word because there's always hope, and it might just take, nearly three decades to get there. And I kind of loved it. And I don't know if it's the best thing I've seen this year, but it sure might be.
It's interesting too, because there's a big like kind of Brexit isolationist metaphor here.
Absolutely. Boyle said that explicitly.
Look, I always think it's very tricky to make these sort of metaphors with the zombies themselves. Like, for instance, in 28 Weeks Later, it's a big metaphor for Iraq and war on terror. Except the problem when you make a movie like this and you have, say, American troops having to gun down a bunch of zombies, you're making a very tricky point there with who's being gunned down and why. And
that, we should note that 28 Weeks Later, the sequel, was not written by Alex Garland or directed by Danny Boyle.
Yeah. Different team. But this idea that it is a critique of Brexit, that it's a critique of the idea of the English self-conception, again, I find kind of interesting, but also vaguely incoherent, since like the isolation works and it actually does keep their village safe and relatively prosperous and healthy in a situation where the rest of the country has been destroyed. Like, maybe if you are surrounded by monsters, you should be isolated. I don't know. Alyssa, what do you make of the movie?
So I wanted to note something about sort of the level of violence first, because Peter, you know, you mentioned like maybe wanting to sort of warn people. And as the most squeamish member of this podcast, I actually found the techniques, the sort of cinematic techniques in this movie made the violence a lot more bearable for the most part. Like the decision to sort of shoot some of the like gorier zombie attacks in infrared, the choice to kind of like freeze the action when the zombies get shot. It's still upsetting and frightening, but I definitely found it much more manageable than I had expected it to. And I think it's like, it's a really interesting set of aesthetic choices. But if you are squeamish, you may find this like somewhat less upsetting than you, would otherwise assume. But where I found this movie really interesting and really profoundly moving in a way is as a movie about religion and about faith, right? Because the opening sequence involves a pastor sort of like in this state of kind of obscene religious ecstasy, right? Like essentially saying like judgment has arrived. And it's sort of an inversion of Christianity, right? And like the father sacrifices himself and saves his son. And gives his son this, you know, this crucifix that reappears at the end of the movie. And there are a lot of very interesting sort of Christian inversions in this movie, right? You know, you have the father sacrificing himself to save the son. You have like a pregnant infected who, you know, in a sort of inverse virgin birth, like gives birth to a child who is not infected through the sort of magic of the placenta, as Dr. Kelsen puts it. And then you have what's clearly the creation of like a sort of perverted religious cult at the end of the movie, like that's sort of threaded through. Like you see at one point, Spike and his father encounter an infected that has been sort of mutilated, hung upside down, and has the word like Jimmy carved into its back. That actual Jimmy is the child we met at the beginning of the film, who reemerges wearing the cross upside, like that his father's crucifix upside down. You know, we see some graffiti about like sort of Jimmy is coming. You know, there is clearly that sort of perversion of Christianity. But then you also have this remarkable kind of statement of faith in the form of Dr. Kelsen's bone temple. And we were talking about this sort of before the podcast about how this movie is genuinely surprising, and it's a great use of trailers to build surprise, right? Because a recurring visual motif in the trailer was this temple that's made of bones. And the implication is that like something really horrific is happening. Right. That like this throughout the movie, it's sort of set up that this doctor is some kind of monster. We know that he's been like laying out enormous numbers of bodies or this fire that never stops burning. And in fact, like what Dr. Kelsen is, in addition to like being someone who's figured out, it's like, oh, iodine keeps you from getting the virus, et cetera, has built like essentially this open air Capuchin monastery. Right. Like introduces Spike to the idea of like memento mori, like remember that we're all going to die. But it's also this just like this beautiful testament, right? In the middle of this wasteland, he is giving unbelievable sort of tender care to these bones. He's giving people a memorial, even though no one is around to see it. And it's like, I found it like, I'm actually getting sort of teary thinking about it. Like I found that really kind of beautiful. And Kelsen is this, you know, this benevolent figure. He's maybe also insane, but like he gives Isla, Spike's mother, like a good death, which is, again, something that, is an idea in, you know, sort of, you know, there was this sort of Christian ideal of the good death, especially that you see a lot in Victorian literature. And like he gives her that. He gives her a good death in, you know, a landscape where like life has become a kind of obscenity. I think it's really beautiful in a lot of ways. And it reminded me of some of the sort of religious fascinations, both in men and in Devs, which I think all of us thought was like maybe the best thing we saw in 2020, where, you know, there is this desire to like have this technologically mediated encounter with Christ on the cross, right? You know, I think Garland is just is thinking about religion in some very interesting ways right now. And yeah, I find this movie just almost unbearably moving at times. But I think it is a really fascinating exploration of faith. And of, you know, sort of Christianity in some ways that I have to imagine will be heightened in the sequel. But I'm really interested to see it.
Yeah, this is one of those movies that is not being sold as a part one of two or possibly three to people. So there's a chance folks might be surprised and/or annoyed by that when they get to it. You know, as a public service announcement, this is there is a sequel that's already shot in the can. It's coming January of 2026. The hope is that these two will do well enough that somebody signs off on a third, and they can make that. So it's there's a planned 28 years trilogy. So you know we'll see if we get that. But I spent some time growing up in England. I lived in England from like 6 to 9 or so, and a lot of the imagery here from the like castle in the background of the island, right, to the or not on the island, on the mainland, to the invocation of giants, like the alphas are kind of portrayed as,
yep,
again, these like the idea of the English giant is, you know, kind of a running running myth. The folks manning the battlements of their, you know, pathetic little fortress, thinking of themselves as arrowmen, you know, shooting at archers, shooting at the oncoming hordes. Again, there's this very English idea of, and to be fair, I want to be totally clear here. It's a critique of this idea in many ways. It is not this kind of idea of Britain, of England as the last, yeah, bastion against, you know, the barbarian hordes, et cetera, is really interesting and fascinating. And I'm very curious to see what direction they go with this in.
Yeah. Also, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that because it, have both of you read Wolf Hall?
No,
I read the first 20 pages.
So I've probably reread Wolf Hall like 10 times. I love that book. What Peter is to like rewatching movies, I probably am to rereading books. But there is this, like, there's this wonderful, history there. There's this wonderful chapter in that book, it's an occult history of Britain, that's about sort of this sense of British strangeness. This shows up too in like A.S. Byatt's Possession. But there is like a sense that Britain was kind of wild in some way. And like, in fact, the Arthurian legend is partially about sort of the end of pagan Britain and the rise of Christian Britain. But yes, there's this sense in British mythology that like there's something strange in the landscape. There are giants. There are, you know, women who are like part fish. There, you know, there's just, you know, something strange in the landscape that is coming back that I think emerges really beautifully in this movie.
Yeah. And again, the sequel is directed by Nia DaCosta. Did she write it? I don't know who the credited
writer.
Garland wrote it.
Okay. Yeah. So I'll be curious to see precisely what she does with this idea. If she does anything, yeah, at all, if she goes a different direction entirely. But it'll be curious to see.
We know that it is much more the story of Jimmy. Who is, if you guys don't know, I didn't know this when I saw the movie, but is clearly a reference to a somewhat famous British television personality who was found after his death to have abused a very, very large number of children. Jimmy, yeah, Savile, I believe is his name.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That was a reference I did not catch. And see, this is, I want to bring this back to our discussion at Cons and Nons real quick before we sign off here, because this is a movie that I think could not be made by somebody who was not British, who did not understand English self sentiment in a very real. And Boyle, like, whatever else you want to say about him, Boyle is the one of the probably two or three great British filmmakers right now, right? He did the Olympic opening ceremony for London back in 2012. He is like the guy who has kind of been entrusted with creating this idea of Britain for that ceremony, and kind of has carried that on elsewhere. And I just like, this is not a movie that an American director could have made. Michael Bay couldn't have made this movie. He would have made a different 28 years later, right? Like, you know, you do not, Steven Spielberg doesn't make this movie. He makes a different version of this movie. And I think that is like one argument in favor of kind of trying to limit who tells these stories. Now, again, it's not a total argument, but it is one that I think is worth at least considering. So, I don't know. Final thought. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on 28 years later? Peter.
Thumbs up. Maybe the best movie I've seen this year so far.
Alyssa.
Thumbs up. Definitely in my top five.
Certainly thumbs up. And again, I like this and Sinners 1 and 1A for me. Sinners probably a little bit tighter, a little bit better structured. This, again, feels a little episodic, but still was very, very good. So big thumbs up from me on this. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Danny Dorst, who is still filling in for Rupert Manderstam. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.